since you brought up the computer programs, which I knew nothing about, are you using developed programs? Are you developing your own programs?
Well, I mean, we've developed this particular way of using the program in order to calculate the thing. But the computer program itself is a thing that I steal from my colleague Richard Friesner. It's a program called Jaguar. You know, we're lucky in this department. We have a very strong theoretical group. And Friesner, F-R-I-E-S-N-E-R, Richard Friesner, is one of the developers of a program called Jaguar, which is a an ab initio good program, and he has ways of putting solvation in this so-called continuum solvent. In other words, when you put water in, you put it in terms of its bulk properties, but you don't put individual water molecules in, although you could in principle do that. But so we've been using his program, and it's very helpful, and he's right here, and we sometimes have to make some other parameters or whatever for the thing. You know, he's right here to do all that, so that's very helpful. So we have not been looking at anybody and other programs. There are other ways of doing this. You know, Bill Jorgensen at Yale has some computational things he does, and I'm sure he's not using Friesen's program. He's using something else. But most people who are doing this stuff seriously now are using ab initio methods, not using these parameterized methods. You know, the kind of things Michael Doerr, you know, developed, that sort of stuff. Most people are tending not to do that, because I guess the assumption is if you have to use parameterized methods, then there's always a danger that the parameters are going to fail for the case you're interested in. And the ab initio things, in principle, don't require that. The problem is they don't always work, you know.
Right.
But I think it's clearly where the thing is going to go. What has limited it largely has been computational power, but that's so much better now that it's not a big factor. So we're doing that. And the student, I have one student who's doing that. He's very, very good, very intelligent man, I must say. And he's doing about half calculations and half experimental stuff. And that's a very good combination. I even have him synthesizing a molecule because I don't want him to get out of this group and made something. So he's making an interesting, challenging molecule besides everything else.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that in one of the articles that you have, like to have your students all make something.
They better. If they're going to come out, see, that's the great power that organic chemistry has. No other field has. I mean, these other guys all have to ask us, can you give me this molecule or can we buy it? I mean, it's a fantastic power. And I think the estimate I heard, it's a very, very interesting estimate, is that we have made less than 1%, by a lot less than 1%, of all the conceivable molecules under molecular weight 500 that have just carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus, you know, a few of the non-normal elements. We're nowhere near exploring the whole available world, and so that doesn't mean we want to do it necessarily, but it does mean there's a lot of need to make new things, you know, in order to explore stuff. You know.
For about 25 years now, you've been collaborating with colleagues at the DeWitt Wallace Research Labs, and you have to tell me what those are, and Sloan Kettering on cytodifferentiated
agents. The DeWitt Wallace Research Labs is somebody who just came into that one paper for their particular contribution. The contribution has been, the collaboration has been with the people at Sloan Kettering, but actually it started first when everybody was at Columbia. I started collaborating with a man who was at one point the dean of the medical school at Columbia and is now the head of Sloan Kettering, named Paul Marks, M-A-R-K-S, and with Richard Rifkind, R-I-F-K-I-N-D, who is a who was at that point a professor of medicine at the medical school and is now director of research at Sloan Kettering. And so that's really the sort of the tripartite collaboration. This other operation, from time to time, people have gotten into this who've done some particular things with our compounds. But that thing developed very interestingly. We haven't talked about that, I think.
No.
Okay. So, but let me tell you that story, because that's really a wonderful story.
Yeah, that's the one I want to hear.
Story. All right, so what happens the following? A woman named Charlotte Friend, F-R-I-E-N-D, who was at that point at Mount Sinai Medical School, was studying what were called friend cells, named for her. At least she didn't name it that, but everybody else calls them friend cells. These were so-called pre-erythrocytes. Erythrocytes, red blood cells, as essentially every cell, are formed from some kind of a stem cell. That is, the first you make a sort of a juvenile form, and then that form differentiates to the adult form. So the first thing that can be a red cell isn't. That is, the first thing, a so-called pre-erythrocyte, is white. It has no hemoglobin in it, and it's spherical. And then eventually it becomes an erythrocyte, a red cell. It develops hemoglobin, becomes red, and it also flattens out. It looks a little bit like sort of a discus with fat edges. You know, the red cell has a very different look from a sphere. And so these pre-erythrocytes normally differentiate, and they have two jobs. They have to multiply because you have to make more stem cells, and they also have to differentiate to an adult form. Adult cells normally don't proliferate at any significant rate. That is, you make new tissue by making new stem cells and multiplying them and then differentiating to the adult form. Mm-hmm. You don't usually get, you know, red cells don't, for instance, make more red cells. So they all come from this kind of pattern.
Okay.
Well, what happened is when this pre-erythrocyte is infected with a virus, which is called the erythroleukemia virus, and I can, you want me to spell it? Or what?
No.
Erythroleukemia virus. Then animals which have that infection develop a condition called erythroleukemia, in which their stem cells are simply making more stem cells but are not making red cells anymore, and so they don't have the erythrocytes they need. And that's because you have changed the balance between proliferation and differentiation. And various biological studies made it clear that what you had done was fundamentally cut off the differentiation path. You hadn't so much speeded up proliferation, you simply cut off this differentiation path. And so what Charlotte Friend had been trying to do was to soak some of these pre-erythrocytes that were not differentiating at all. She had a whole tube full of these things, soak them in aqueous DMSO to soften up the membrane so she could get something into the cells. And she came back and looked at it several days later, and the tube had turned red. And she looked at it under the microscope, and these were erythrocytes in there. So that this thing, which would never have differentiated before, differentiated as a result of having dimethyl sulfoxide in the medium. Not an anti-hydrophobic effect, a different effect, it turned out. So Paul Marx came, she talked to him about it, because he was in hematological oncology, essentially leukemia areas was one of his special areas. She came and she talked to him about it, what could be going on here, and he decided he really had to talk to a chemist about what on earth could be going on. So he came down to talk to me, because we knew each other, and said, this is going on, and what could be going on here, and, you know, what if anything could we do about it? The level of DMSO that was required to differentiate these cells was about 280 millimolar. So if you took a guess that you were going to use this as a technique deal with human cancer, you would have to titrate people up to a level which was preposterous, and so nobody really thought that was a serious possibility. Well, the first thing we did was to see whether just polar solvents in general did this, and whether it had anything special to do with methyl metabolism or things of that kind, which it could have, and it didn't. It was just polar solvents. In fact, amides were better than DMSO, so cetamide, things like that, dimethyl cetamide. These were better than DMSO, but not a lot better. You still needed like 100 millimolar, so you hadn't gained much. And so then I had to guess, well, how can we make this whole thing better? And I said, well, maybe if we're lucky, the reason you need so much is that there are two pockets into which you bind, and those pockets might be nearby. And if so...
This was just a guess on your
part. A guess. Okay. We knew nothing. Well, now we know where these things go. But now we didn't have time to know anything. We said, if maybe there are two pockets into which they go, and maybe these pockets are close enough that we can take advantage of the chelate effect and lump two of them together so that when one goes in, the other one is sort of automatically there, right, and you get much stronger binding than you would with separate molecules. And so I explained this to actually a postdoc, a very, very smart guy, postdoc, and he said, well, this is all very amusing, but because we know nothing about all this, and by the way, what kind of linker should we put between these two things to bind to these hypothetical pockets? And I said, well, look, the truth is we don't know whether it's going to be working. It will work, but it's not hard to find out. And every chemist knows that when in doubt, the number 6 is the magic number. So put 6 methylene groups between these two amides, and let's see what happens. It turns out he made the molecule. He put it in. It was about 100 times more effective. That is, we were down to 1 millimolar instead of 100 millimolar for simple amides. And furthermore, 6 was the magic number. That is when we varied the methylenes. 5 was not as good. 7 was not as good. We had a curve that peaked at 6. You know.
So you started with hexamethylenediamine or something?
Yeah, hexamethylenediamine. It just made abyssacetamide. We started essentially with nylon, more or less. You know,
yeah, okay.
I mean, highly available compound. We made abyssacetamide of that.
Right.
And that thing is called hexamethylene abyssacetamide. And that compound actually had been studied quite extensively. And it turns out that it was very effective, not just against these Charlotte Friend pre-erythrocytes. I mean, it differentiated them all right, very well. But then it did a lot of other things, too. We looked at human cell tumors of various kinds. There was a so-called HT29, there was a colon tumor, there was a human leukemia, normal leukemia tumor, not this funny erythral leukemia thing. And these cells were also differentiated so that they quit multiplying and they essentially behaved like sort of normal adult cells. And then we started looking at developed tumors with this stuff, and we were able to arrest the growth of those tumors. And so at that point, we said, okay,
Now we're talking 20 years ago, or 15 years
that's
ago.
That's right, exactly, a long time ago. We were able to get some things out of that. And so we showed that the doses required was still awfully high. And we weren't really happy with that, but that's what we had. You know, 1 millimolar is still a lot of stuff.
Right.
And hexamethylene bisacetamide has a problem that it deacetylates and you make diamines, and you don't want one of those diamines floating around at decent levels, you know.
Right.
So that was a problem. We weren't happy about that. But anyhow, the compound looked pretty good, and so they filed a so-called IND, and they got permission to do clinical trials with the stuff because they showed it wasn't a big problem with animals. And they went into dogs, and there was no great toxicity of the stuff. So they went in and they had a group of patients which they studied for a particular form of leukemia. And most of those patients got a good response right away. And many of them, you know, who had been sick in bed got up and were able to walk around, etc. But most of them eventually succumbed. We were not ever able to get blood levels of these people up to what we thought we needed in order to do this. And so, in fact, eventually the disease took over. But for a while, at least, we had knocked it out. But one remarkable patient of this group was, for some reason, her disease was particularly susceptible to this stuff. And she's still alive. And she was supposed to be dead in 2 months.
And this is how long ago?
This is about 12 years ago now. Yeah. So she's still alive. So for her, this has been an enormous success, this thing, because she's still alive. As far as she had what's called smoker's cancer, so-called non-small small cell lung cancer, which is what smokers get. She had this thing, and it was roaring along, and she had been through every normal treatment, and they couldn't control it. And she went on our stuff, and after a year, you know, they didn't want to biopsy the lung, because that's a very invasive, but they were taking x-rays. After a year, they couldn't see any sign of the tumor. It had just essentially stopped growing, and then it had disappeared. And so after a year or so,
and this is HMBA.
HMBA, yeah. After a year or so, we convinced her that she didn't have to continue to take the stuff because our studies had shown that if we exposed tissue culture for a significant length of time, then the transformation was permanent. If we took the stuff away early, then the cells reverted.
Mm-hmm.
But if we exposed her for a significant length of time, then the transformation was permanent. And so that seems to be true with her. I know she's not on the drug. But for most people, obviously, the doses required were not appealing. And so we knew that this hexamethylene bisacetamide was one way of making a bisamide, but you could also turn the amide group around and have the nitrogen on the outside. That also was effective, and just about equal, but not any better. But then I decided that if we thought about this seriously, you have to ask, well, what are we binding to? I mean, amides either make hydrogen bonds or they bind to metals. There's really nothing else you can do with an amide. And in either case, a hydroxamic acid is going to be a better ligand. It's going to make more hydrogen bonds. And if it's a metal that you're targeting, which in fact we now know is true, if it's a metal that you're targeting, then the hydroxamic acid is going to be a better group. So we made a bis hydroxamic acid, and we got another 10 to the 2 out of the efficacy. So now we were talking about things down in the sort of middle micromolar region, you know, 20, 30 micromolar, that kind of thing. So that was pretty good. And then we made a number of compounds like that with different spacers. You know, we weren't just putting six methylenes in there. We had all kinds of benzene rings and all that sort of thing. And some of these things were really quite interesting. We put some rigidification into those spacers, and some of that was helpful. But, you know, not hugely. We never really made a big breakthrough there. But then I decided that we had no evidence at all that both ends had to be hydroxamic acids. And it seemed unlikely in a way that both ends were doing the same thing. You know, why would that be true? And so we decided, well, let's find out whether maybe a hydrophobic group on one end would do something if you're taking any protein binding off in the pockets into which things bind. So we made a thing with a hydroxamic acid at one end and a benzene amide at the other, essentially. So we had a benzene ring at the other and various versions of that. And that gave us another factor, I guess, a little more than a factor of 10. So we got down to the region of relatively low micromolar, but still not into the nanomolar region. You know, but like one or two micromolar we were at for the differentiation induction. And that compound, which we call SAHA, it's
S-A-H-A?
S-A-H-A, yeah. That's an acronym for, I don't know what it is, hydroxamic acid, you know, suberoweal annelid hydroxamate, I guess is what it is. So we had suberic acid, that's the dicarboxylic acid. We had the annelid at one end, and we had the other end was a hydroxamic acid, that was SAHA. That compound turned out to be very interesting, and that has been through a lot of studies, and that's the one that's a compound closely related to that is the one that's going to go into the clinic, as far as we know, this summer. But what is done with SAHA, perhaps the most exciting things, well, there are two exciting things that were done with it. For one thing, it was put into mice that have so-called xenografts, that is, that have foreign tumors in them, so-called nude mice. You know, these are mice that don't reject things that easily. So you can put a human tumor into a mouse, and the mouse will not reject it automatically. So some of that was done, and we got regression of those tumors. But then, more seriously, two things were done. A collection of our best compounds were sent down to the National Cancer Institute. And they looked at they have a library, I think, of close to 70 human tumor cell lines. And they looked at these things with our compounds, including SAHA, and they all stopped growing. Some of them simply stopped growing and were still viable. Some of them went into what's called programmed death, apoptosis, sometimes people pronounce it. The second P should be silent, but nobody ever does that. But the apoptosis is a thing that cells can go into, which is essentially, if you're screwing up what it is they would like to do, they decide to hell with this and they stop. But it's not anything that happens to normal cells. I mean, so the cancer cells were doing this. So that was fine. We were killing them selectively because they went into this programmed cell death, and then some of them simply stopped growing. And so then what was also done was to take these human cancers, this is done at National Cancer Institute now, and put them into porous tubes that were implanted in the peritoneum of rats. And then you don't have to worry about nude mice or anything like that, because the rats can't interfere with those human tumor cells because they're not in contact, because they're inside a porous tube. But drugs can diffuse into the thing. So then the drugs were administered to the animals, and so they were processed, whatever the animal did to them, and at some point diffused into the peritoneal tubes. And we got tremendous response. I mean, the National Cancer Institute said they had never seen such a collection of highly effective compounds. And so then we had to zero in on which were the best. So we went in and picked out two of them that looked great. And one of them was closely related to SAHA. But the difference from SAHA is that instead of having a benzene ring, we had a pyridine ring. It's about as hydrophobic, but it gives it a little better water solubility and a little better ability, therefore, to be used as a drug in various ways. And so the one that's actually going to fly, I think, is the one which is SAHA, except that instead of an annelid, it's an amino pyridine that one has in there. And but it's almost the same compound, but as I say, it's better soluble. And it turns out that was important for some of the toxicity studies. Anyhow, feeding studies were also done. That may be the group that you were mentioning, this other operation. Anyhow, feeding studies were also done with Zaha, and that was put into the feed of rats, and then a control group just ate their normal feed. And the bunch that ate the stuff that had our thing in it, Doug, didn't mind it. I mean, they ate the feed perfectly well. No funny things happened. If you start doing bad things to rats, they start losing their hair. These didn't lose any. Or they start doing funny things. If there's any neurological effects, there were none. The rats behaved normally. And then they were all injected with nitrosomethylurea. And the control group all got massive mammary tumors. And ours got many fewer. And they were small. And didn't seem to be much of a problem, but, you know, little lumps. So it's not as if nothing happened to them with nitrosomethylurea. But whatever happened to them didn't seem to be a big problem compared to the control group. And so the guy who does this work has done a lot of feeding experiments trying to look at the so-called chemo-preventive agents, and he said he's never seen anything as good as that, and so that was good. So, you know, just not the results plus his own experience.
This is here or not at the National Institute of Health?
This is that institute somewhere. That we don't, you know, we didn't do feeding. So this is a guy who does this stuff for a living, a guy named Cohen. He does this stuff for a living, and so he was the one who did that stuff. And so that, plus their own experience, convinced the National Cancer Institute that they had something really good. And so they then started a serious study on the preclinical toxicology, and they did rats and they did dogs, and they didn't see any big problems. The closest to any problem at all was when dogs were on a so-called 7-day infusion of the compound, this pen, you know, infusing it directly into their veins. At first, white cell counts went down a bit, but then they came back even though the drug was still being administered. And they said they've never seen that either, because most things knock down white cells because they're tremendously sensitive. Mm-hmm. And any kind of toxic compound knocks them down. But we must not have been, either we knocked them down and for some reason they recovered, or we were just temporarily shunting them into some kind of a reservoir somewhere. We don't know what happened. We don't know why this happened.
Right.
But anyway, the white cells came back to normal, even though the drug was being administered. And so they're very excited about that. And so they are now doing the last part of the toxicology that you really have to do before you can go to the FDA, which is another set of studies with animals using now drug manufactured by what are called good manufacturing processes. That is, when they have a contractor who can make this stuff in bulk, it's an easy compound to make. We gave them, you know, the procedure of making it, but it's an easy compound to make. He's made this stuff in bulk, and he's made it carefully in such a way that there's absolutely reproducible lots, so that whatever we learn with animals, we're going to be able to take the same kind of material and put it in humans. You have to do that stuff. That's going on right now. It's going into the animals. The animals are not only being looked at for gross symptoms, but they're being looked at very carefully by pathologists, looking at all the tissues to see that no funny things have happened of any kind. But, you know, you don't know until the thing is over that it's all right. But I think it's awfully unlikely that it's a problem, because we've never seen any symptoms of anything before. So assuming that this preclinical tox works all right, we should go into phase one sometime in the summer. They're talking about July or August at the latest, you know, with this thing. And so we're going to phase one clinical trials and see what happens with humans, you know, with this stuff.
It's very exciting.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It has tremendous potential.
Are they looking at specific types of cancer patients now?
I mean, they're not in human trials yet.
I mean, when they do,
yeah, you generally have to do that. You generally have to, your phase one trials, in principle, what you're trying to find out is the drug tolerated by humans? Are there any adverse effects that you hadn't thought of? Of course, it's hard to imagine adverse effects worse than this disease itself.
Right.
So you have to be a little bit careful about saying, well, you know, suppose it caused a brittleness of your hair or something. I mean, who would worry about crap like that?
Right.
So, I mean, this is a serious disease we're dealing with here. So the chances that there'll be a problem, I think, are small. And people are already talking about when they finish phase one, how we're going to do phase two. You know, and with phase two, you go after serious business where there you're supposedly trying to demonstrate that you're actually curing disease. Phase one, you're supposed to be doing this other stuff. But in real life, what you always do is you do it in cancer patients, because after all, people have to have a reason to volunteer. And so, besides everything else, you also say, oh, and Bolton, by the way, did it help, you know? So that's what goes on in phase one. And then phase two is a serious effort to do that, double-blind studies, that kind of thing, you know? And then phase three, and then you're out into the world. No, I think it's tremendously exciting. I think that the only ambiguity is, will somebody come up with something better? But that's fine. That's fine. Right. You know, I mean, what kind of a downside is that? Okay. But if nobody comes up with something better than this, I think this has really interesting potential. And it's rather broad. That is, we have not found any cell types in tissue culture that don't respond to this stuff. I mean, it does so-called neuroblastomas, which means you're going to go after brain tumors, and yet it does also leukemia. You know, you're going to go after liquid. You're going to go after, and we don't see, there's nothing that seems to be, I mean, some things are better responsive than others, and some compounds are better at some things than others in their NCI tests. That was part of the criteria we used in picking compound. We picked the compound that looked like, among other things, the best broad spectrum material, which is what the Saha thing is. I mean, some of the other compounds were a little better at something else, but they weren't quite as good, you know, for things. So this is the best broad spectrum thing. No, I think it's very exciting, and we'll have to see how it all works out. We've been talking to drug companies. We've been talking to an outfit that does a lot of the they act as agents between academic discoveries and companies to try. And we've got to find ourselves a good industrial partner, because we're not interested in setting up a company. You're not interested in making money out of this. We just want to get it out. Right. And so our best bet is to find a company that will really push it out and has the resources to finance the clinical trials and all the rest and get it going. You know, if it really works, it's a crime in a way that it has taken so long to get to this point. But part of it, honestly, has been that we keep getting better compounds, and we're still working on it. I have three people now working in the lab. They're interesting people. One is an MD, PhD student. He spent 2 years in medical school, and now he's getting 4 years here for a PhD and then 1 year in medical school again. And he'll get it with an MD and a PhD, and he's an excellent chemist. He was a Dartmouth chemistry major undergraduate and really did a lot of research at Dartmouth. So he's excellent, and he's knocking the stuff out. And then I've got another graduate student, a very good graduate student, who's also working with just a straight organic graduate student. And then there's a woman from Japan who's come over who's a medicinal chemist, and she's going to be working in my lab for not quite half a year, just on their expense, you know, just to sort of find out what we do over here. And she's knocking out compounds. So we think one way or the other we can probably get better compounds. You know, that's always what you want. But the NCI's position is interesting. They say, look, this compound is not toxic, it's effective, it's chemically stable, and it's easy to make. And while you put that all together, then, you know, you don't necessarily need a better compound. I mean, the estimate for a human dose would be of the order of an aspirin tablet kind of stuff of a fairly easily available compound. So, you know, suppose we could make it 100 times more effective. Do we know that we wouldn't bring in toxicity? You know, so who knows? So their position is, look, this is what we want to do, and let's make sure that this type of thing really is effective in humans. Then we can always worry about better compounds later. Anyhow, we're in the better compound game, but because I think that's what we need to do. And we're trying to make backups in case something funny happens with this one, that we'll have something behind it. But we have four or five compounds already, you know, that are comparable to it. That's why we had to choose in the NCI which one to go with. No, it's pretty good stuff, actually. There's no question. It's not very physical organic, but it started with a physical organic idea, chelate effect. Yes. After that, it took off.
Right. Really nice. I think I've finished most of the chemical work, and
good.
So I want to ask a few questions about. You've been here at Columbia for almost 44 years. What major changes have you seen take place?
Let's see, I came here in 1956. Yeah, you're right. I didn't realize it was that much. Well, there have been huge changes in the place, thank God. It was at one point when I came here a rather parochial place. They were a little frightened because at one point they knew they had been a great institution and they couldn't figure out quite what had happened, you know. They were slipping. A part of the problem was that they did not have a very effective fundraising operation, and part of the problem was that they were horribly inbred. A good fraction of the faculty did both their undergraduate and their graduate degrees here and stayed on. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, everybody has some of that. Harvard, frankly, has more of it than they'll admit to, but still, it was horribly inbred, but not in the chemistry department. The chemistry department was pretty good, but the university... That also extended to the administration. So they never, you know, they knew what was the Columbia way of doing things, and you didn't change it. And so that was really paralyzed. And so a number of things changed. Some of them actually had some role in. The one that I think was probably the most important for the Columbia undergraduate population was that I became chairman of the committee to make the place co-ed, because we were a male college. And what happened is that they had desultory...
Except the females were across the street.
Well, I know. So we had Barnard College. See, but Barnard College is not truly part of Columbia. It has an affiliate arrangement. They have their own endowment. They have their own president, their own board of trustees, their own faculty. Mm-hmm. And so they really are a separate small college, which happens to have a very close connection. Should we stop talking now, or where are we? Okay. So everybody was figured that the way for us to become co-ed is to somehow arrange a thing where we would absorb Barnard. And they say then Barnard would be to Columbia as Radcliffe is to Harvard, you know, sort of a name but not a real separate. But Radcliffe is not a separate institution, but Barnard is. And they said, well, we have to do that because if we went co-ed on our own, that would kill Barnard. And that was always the argument, that Barnard couldn't possibly survive a co-ed Columbia next to an all-female Barnard. So I was convinced that I had to deal with that question because there was no other way of dealing with this. I mean, that was the thing. At one point, the president said to me, they were afraid if we went co-ed that we would have a corpse as a partner, you know, and so they were frightened of it. So what I did, instead of dealing around with why it was a... What happened here? Let's see. This thing came out. Should I...
And why don't we stop?
Yeah.